up here. I need you to cut all power to our computing facility.
Cut it, sir?
That's correct. Okay, she said. It'll take a few minutes. You're aware, though, that your data processing department is on a UPS. You know, an uninterruptible power supply. It'll run on batteries for a while.
How long?
If everything's turned on, only 6 or 7 minutes, just enough to weather any short blackout.
Can you disconnect the UPS?
Sure, if you like.
It'll have to be physically unplugged. I can't turn it off from down here. I'm the only one on duty right now. Can I get someone to do it for you tomorrow?
This is an emergency, said Sarker. Can you come up and show us how to do it? I've someone here with me if it's warm bodies you need.
Okay. You want me to cut the mains before I come up?
No, we'll cut them after the UPS is disconnected.
He covered the mouthpiece and spoke to Peter.
That means everything will go off at once, without giving the Sims any warning.
Peter nodded.
Whatever you say, sir, said the maintenance person. Give me a few minutes, then I'll be up.
Sarker put down the phone.
What will you do once the power is off? Asked Peter.
Sarker was already on the floor, trying to remove an access panel from underneath the computer console.
Take out the optical drives and hook them up to a test bench. I can zap data on a bit-by-bit basis, if need be, using a Norton laser. So,
the phone rang.
Can you get that? Sarker said, struggling with a stubborn wingnut.
The video phone's screen displayed a notice that the incoming call was audio only. Peter picked up the handset.
Hello?
There was staticky silence for about 2 seconds, then an obviously synthesized voice came on.
Hello, it said.
Peter felt himself flush with anger. He hated computerized telephone solicitations. He was in the process of slamming down the receiver when he heard the next word.
Peter.
In the split second before the handset hit the cradle, he realized that even if the soliciting computer was working from an online phone directory, there's no way a stranger would expect to find him at this number. He stopped short and pulled the receiver back to his face.
"Who is this?" he said. He glanced down at the lights on the phone desk set. This wasn't a call being transferred internally. It was coming over an outside line.
"It's," said the voice, dull and mechanical,
"you."
Peter held the handset in front of his face, looking at it as if it were a serpent. More words came from the earpiece, each one separated from the next by a small, static-filled space.
"Surely you didn't expect us to stay cooped up on that small workstation."
The maintenance person arrived a few minutes later carrying a toolbox. Sarker looked up at her, turmoil plain, at least to Peter's eyes, on Sarker's face.
"All set," she said.
"No," said Sarker. "Sorry to have dragged you up here. We don't need to disconnect the UPS anymore, or to cut the mains."
The woman looked surprised.
"Whatever you say."
"My apologies," said Sarker. She nodded and left.
Peter and Sarker sat staring at each other, dumbfounded.
"We really fucked up, didn't we?" said Peter at last.
Sarker nodded.
"Damn," said Peter.
"God damn it."
A long pause.
"There's no way to shut them off now that they're out in the net, is there?"
Sarker shook his head.
"Now what?" said Peter.
"I don't know," said Sarker. "I don't know."
"If we knew which sim was responsible, maybe we could find a way to isolate that particular one, but damn, how do we figure that out?"
"Morality," said Sarker.
"What?
Do you know Lawrence Kohlberg?"
Peter shook his head.
"He was a psychologist who did research on moral reasoning back in the 1960s. I studied him while preparing an expert system for the Clark Institute of Psychiatry."
"So?"
"So this whole mess is a question of morality. Why one version of you would behave differently from the others. Surely the key to which Sim is guilty is tied into the nature of human morality."
Peter wasn't really listening.
"Is there anything else we can do to erase the Sims?"
"Not now that they're out in the net." Look, you're probably right. It will be useful to identify which Sim is guilty. Let me ask you a question. What? Sarka paused, remembering. Say a man's wife is terminally ill, but she could be saved by a drug that costs $20,000. What's this got to do with anything? Just listen. It's one of Kohlberg's test scenarios. Suppose that the man had only been able to come up with $10,000, but the pharmacist refused to let him have the drug, even though he promised to pay the rest of the cost later. The man then steals the drug to save his wife's life. Is the man's act morally right or wrong? Peter frowned. It's right, of course. But why? That's the key. I don't know, it just is. Sarka nodded. I suspect each Sim would give a different reason. Kohlberg defined 6 levels of moral reasoning. At the lowest, one believes moral behavior is simply that which avoids punishment. At the highest, which Kohlberg considered the province of moral giants like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, moral behavior is based on abstract ethical principles. At that stage, external laws against theft are irrelevant. Your own internalized moral code would dictate that you must value another's life more greatly than any repercussions you might suffer yourself because of the crime. Well, that's what I believe. Mahatma Hobson, said Sarka. Presumably, the control Sim would share that same point of view, but Kohlberg found that criminals were likely to be at a lower stage of moral reasoning than non-criminals of the same age who had the same IQ. Ambritos might be fixated at the lowest level, level 1, the avoidance of punishment. Why? An immortal will live forever, but he can also spend forever in jail. A life sentence would be a terrifying thought to him. But how often does a true life sentence get handed down? You know the old saying, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. Well, Ambritos might very well think he could do any crime, because after all, he can do the time. Good point, said Sarka. But I still think he's the guilty one. They say time heals all wounds, but perhaps if you knew you were going to live forever, you'd want to deal with anything that was going to fester in your mind for century after century. Peter shook his head. I don't think so. Look, if murder is a terrible crime to me, wouldn't it be unthinkable, the ultimate atrocity to an immortal version of me who knew life could go on forever? Sarka sighed. Perhaps. I guess it could go either way. But what about spirit? His moral reasoning, too, could be fixated at a low level. Even though spirit is dead, we have simulated neither heaven nor hell for him, so perhaps he considers himself to be in purgatory. If he behaves well, maybe he believes he will be allowed entrance to heaven. Kohlberg's second stage defines moral acts as those which gain rewards. Peter shook his head again. I don't really believe in heaven or hell. Sarka tried another tack. Well then, consider this. Murder is a crime of passion, and passion is a failing of flesh and blood. Remove sex from the human psyche, and you would have no reason to kill a philanderer. That would argue for spirit's innocence, and by process of elimination for Ambritos's guilt. Maybe, said Peter. On the other hand, spirit knows there is life after death, knows it by virtue of his existence, so to him murder would be a less heinous crime than it would be for Ambritos, since it's not a complete ending for the victim. Spirit would thus be much more likely to feel comfortable committing murders. Sarka sighed, frustrated. So you could argue that one either way, too. He glanced at his watch. Look, there's nothing more we can do here. He paused. In fact, there may be nothing more we can do anywhere. He sat quietly for a moment, thinking. Go home. Tomorrow is Saturday. I'll come by your place around 10 in the morning, and we can try to figure out what to do next. Peter nodded wearily. But first, Sarka pulled out his wallet, fished out a pair of 50s, and handed them to Peter. What's this? $100 I borrowed from you last week. I want to be sure the Sims have no cause to resent me.
Before we go, send a message into the net telling them that I paid you back.
Net News Digest. A group of protesters announced late yesterday that Florida's SeaWorld, the last U.S. entertainment institution to still keep dolphins in captivity, was refusing their requests to try to determine if dolphins also exhibited the soul wave. George Hendricks, 27, a born-again Christian, today filed suit in Dayton, Ohio, charging that his parents, Daniel and Kim Hendricks, both 53, in failing to have baptized George's brother Paul, who died last year in an automobile accident at age 24, were guilty of neglect and abuse by preventing Paul's soul from being able to enter heaven. Further research from The Hague, Netherlands, indicates that departing soul waves seem to be moving in a very specific direction. At first we thought each wave was going separately, but that's before we took into account the time of day of each individual's death, said bioethics professor Martin Lely. It now seems that all soul waves are traveling in the same direction. For want of a better reference, that direction is approximately toward the constellation of Orion. Germany became the first country today to make it explicitly illegal to interfere in any way with the departure of soul waves from dying bodies. France, Great Britain, Japan, and Mexico are currently debating similar legislation. The suicide rates on native reserves in the United States and Canada, and in the three largest ghettos in the U.S., were at a 5-year high this past month. One suicide note from Los Angeles typified a recurrent theme. Something beyond this life exists. It can't be worse than being here.
Chapter 38. Kathy was lying on her back in bed, staring at the ceiling when Peter entered. He could see by the Hobson monitor that she was wide awake, so he didn't make any effort to be quiet.
"Peter," said Kathy.
"Hmm?
What went on this evening?"
"I had to see Sarker."
Kathy's voice was tightly controlled.
"Do you know who killed my father?
Who killed Hans?"
Peter started to say something, then fell silent.
"Trust," she said, rolling slightly toward him, "has to be a two-way street." She waited a moment. "Do you know who killed them?"
"No," said Peter again, removing his socks, and then a moment later, "not for sure."
"But you have your suspicions."
Peter didn't trust his voice. He nodded in the darkness.
"Who?"
"It's only a guess," he said. "Besides, we're not even sure that your father was murdered."
Firmly.
"Who?"
He let out a long sigh.
"This is going to take some explaining." He had his shirt off now. "Sarker and I have been doing some research into artificial intelligence." Her face, blue-gray in the dim room, was impassive. "Sarker created 3 duplicates of my mind inside a computer." Kathy's voice was tinged with mild surprise.
"You mean expert systems?"
"More than that, much more. He's copied every neuron, every neural net. They are, for all intents and purposes, complete duplicates of my personality."
"I didn't know that sort of thing was possible."
"It's still experimental, but yes, it's possible. Sarker invented the technique."
"God! And you think one of these duplicates was responsible for the murders?"
Peter's voice was faint.
"Maybe."
Kathy's eyes were wide with horror. "But why would duplicates of your mind do something you yourself would not?" Peter had finished changing into his pajamas. "Because 2 of the simulations are not duplicates. Parts of what I am have been removed from them. It's possible that we accidentally deleted whatever was responsible for human morality." He sat on the edge of the bed. "I tell you, I would never kill anyone, not even Hans, but part of me very much wanted him dead."
Kathy's voice was bitter. "And my father? Did part of you want him dead, too?"
Peter shrugged.
Well?
I have never really liked your father, but no, until recently I had no reason to hate him. But then you told me about your counseling session. He hurt you when you were young. He shook your confidence.
And one of the duplicates killed him for that?
A shrug in the darkness.
Turn the fucking things off, said Kathy.
We can't, said Peter. We tried. They've escaped out into the net.
God,
said Kathy, putting all her terror and fury into that single syllable. They were silent for a time. She had moved away from him slightly in the bed. Peter looked at her, trying to decipher the mixture of emotions on her face. At last, her voice trembling slightly, she said,
Is there anyone else you want dead?
Sarker asked me the same thing, he said, annoyed, but I can't think of anyone.
What about me? Said Kathy.
You? Of course not.
But I hurt you.
Yes, but I don't want you dead. Peter's words didn't seem to calm her.
Christ, Peter, how could you do something so stupid?
I don't know. We didn't mean to.
What about the detective?
What about her? What will happen when she gets too close to the truth? Asked Kathy. Will you want her dead, too?
Sarker arrived at Peter and Kathy's house at 10:15 the next morning. They sat there, the three of them, chewing on bagels that were past their prime.
So what do we do now? Said Kathy, arms folded across her chest.
Go to the police, said Sarker.
Peter was shocked.
What?
The police, said Sarker again. This is completely out of control. We need their help.
But call the police. Tell them the truth. This is a new phenomenon. We didn't expect this result. Tell them that.
If you do that, said Kathy slowly, there will be repercussions.
Indeed, said Peter. Charges would be laid.
What charges? Said Sarker. We've done nothing wrong.
Are you kidding? Said Peter. They could charge me with manslaughter, maybe, or as an accessory to murder, and they could charge you with criminal negligence.
Sarker's eyes went wide.
Criminal? Not to mention getting you under hacker laws, said Kathy. If I understand all this correctly, you've created a piece of software that's out there violating other people's computer systems and stealing resources. That's a felony.
But we intended nothing wrong, said Sarker.
The Crown Attorney could run circles around us, said Peter. A man and his best friend create software that kills people the man hated. Easy enough to discredit any claim I didn't have that in mind all along. And remember that case against Consolidated Edison? Frankenstein statutes? Those who seek to profit from technology must bear the costs of unforeseen consequences?
Those are American laws, said Sarker.
I suspect a Canadian court would adopt a similar principle, said Kathy.
Regardless, said Sarker, the Sims have to be stopped.
Yes, said Kathy.
Sarker looked at Peter. Pick up the phone. Dial 911.
But what could the police do? Asked Peter, spreading his arms.
I'd be in favor of telling them, perhaps, if there was something they could do.
They could order a shutdown of the net, said Sarker.
Are you kidding? Only CSIS or the RCMP could do that, and I bet they'd need to invoke the War Measures Act to suspend access to information on that larger scale. Meanwhile, what if the Sims have moved down into the States or across the Atlantic?
Peter shook his head.
There's no way we'd ever get the net scoured clean.
Sarker nodded slowly.
Perhaps you're right.
They were silent for a time. Finally, Kathy said, Isn't there some way you can clean them off the net yourself?
They looked at her expectantly.
You know, she said, write a virus that would track them down and destroy them. I remember the internet worm from back when I was in university. It was all over the world in a matter of days.
Sarker looked excited.
Maybe, he said. Maybe.
Peter looked at him. He tried to keep his voice calm.
The Sims are huge, after all. They can't be that hard to find.
Sarker was nodding.
a virus that checked all files bigger than, say, 10 gigabytes. It could look for 2 or 3 basic patterns from your neural nets. If it found them, it would erase the file. Yes, yes, I think I could write something like that. He turned to Kathy. Brilliant, Catherine.
How long would it take to write? Asked Peter.
I'm not sure, replied Sarker. I've never written a virus before. Couple of days?
Peter nodded.
Let's pray that this works.
Sarker looked at him.
I face Mecca 5 times a day and pray. Perhaps we would have better luck if both of you really did pray too.
He rose to his feet.
I better get going. I've got a lot of work to do.
Chapter 39 Peter had been trying to prepare himself for the inevitable encounter. Still, every time his intercom buzzed, he felt his heart begin to race. The first few times were false alarms. Then,
Peter, said his secretary's voice, there's an Inspector Philo here to see you from the Metro Police.
Peter took a very deep breath, held it for a few seconds, then let it out in a long, whispery sigh. He touched a button on his intercom.
Send her in, please.
A moment later, the door to his office opened, and in walked Alexandria Philo. Peter had expected her to be in a police uniform. Instead, she was wearing a trim, professional gray blazer, matching slacks and a coffee-colored silk blouse. She had on 2 tiny green earrings. Her short hair was bright red, her eyes bright green, and she was tall. She was carrying a black attaché case.
"Hello, detective," Peter said, rising to his feet and extending his hand.
"Hello," Sandra said, giving his hand a firm shake. "I take it you were expecting me."
Why do you say that?"
"I couldn't help overhear you talking to your secretary. You said send her in, but she hadn't told you my first name or given you any other indication that I was a woman."
Peter smiled. "You're very good at your job. My wife had said a few things about you."
"I see." Sandra was quiet, staring expectantly at Peter.
Peter laughed. "On the other hand, I'm very good at my job, too, and a large part of it involves attending meetings with government officials, all of whom have taken courses in interpersonal communication. It's going to take more than just a protracted silence to get me to spill my guts."
Sandra laughed. She hadn't looked pretty to Peter when she came in, but when she laughed, she looked very nice indeed.
"Please have a seat, Miss Philo."
She smiled and took a chair, smoothing out her pants as she sat as if she often wore skirts. Kathy had the same habit. There was a short silence.
"Would you like coffee?" asked Peter.
"Tea."
"Coffee, please, double-double."
She looked uncomfortable.
"This is a part of my job that I don't like, Dr. Hobson."
Peter got up and crossed over to the coffee maker. "Please call me Peter."
"Peter."
She smiled.
"I don't like the way involved parties get treated in a case such as this. We police often bully people with little regard for good manners or the principle of assumed innocence."
Peter handed her a cup of coffee.
"So, doctor," she stopped herself and smiled, "so, Peter, I'm going to have to ask you some questions, and I hope you'll understand that I'm just doing my job."
"Of course."
"As you know, one of your wife's co-workers was murdered."
Peter nodded.
"Yes, it came as quite a shock."
Sandra looked at him with her head tilted to one side.
"I'm sorry," said Peter, confused. "Did I say something wrong?"
"Oh, it's nothing, just that there was evidence that a stunner was used to subdue the victim. Your 'quite a shock' comment struck me as funny."
She raised a hand. "Forgive me, you develop a fairly thick skin in this line of work."
A pause.
"Have you ever used a stunner?"
"No."
"Do you own one?"
"They're illegal in Ontario, except for police work."
Sandra smiled.
"But you can buy them easily in New York or Quebec."
"No," said Peter, "I've never used one."
"I'm sorry to have to ask," said Sandra.
"That darned police training," said Peter.
"Exactly," she smiled.
"Did you know the deceased man?"
Peter tried to say the name nonchalantly.
"Hans Larsen? Sure, I'd met him. I've met most of Kathy's co-workers, either at informal gatherings or at her company's Christmas parties."
"What did you think of him?" of Larson? Peter took a sip of coffee. I thought he was a jerk.
Sandra nodded. A number of people seem to have shared your opinion, although others spoke highly of him.
I suspect that's the way it is for just about everyone, said Peter.
Just about.
Silence again.
Then, look, Peter, you seem like a nice guy. I don't want to bring up painful memories, but I know your wife and Hans, well,
Peter nodded.
Yes, they did. But that was over a long time ago.
Sandra smiled.
True. But it was more recently that your wife told you about it.
And now Larson is dead.
Sandra nodded once.
And now Larson is dead.
Miss Philo, she raised a hand, you can call me Sandra.
Peter smiled.
Sandra.
Play it cool, he thought.
Sarka would have the virus ready today or tomorrow. It'll all be over soon.
Let me tell you something, Sandra. I'm a peaceful person. I don't like wrestling or boxing. I haven't hit anyone since I was a boy. I'd never hit my wife, and if I had a child, I'd never spank him or her.
He took a sip of coffee. Had he said enough? Would more be better? Cool, damn it, be cool.
But all he wanted to do was tell her the truth about himself, not those machine duplicates, but the real him, the flesh and blood him.
I think a lot of the problems in this world come from violence. By spanking our kids, we teach them that there are times when it's okay to hit someone you love, and then we're shocked to discover that these same kids grow up thinking it's okay to hit their spouses.
I don't even kill houseflies, Sandra. I capture them in drinking glasses and take them outside.
You're asking whether I killed Larson, and I'll tell you directly that I might indeed have been angry with him. I might indeed have hated him. But killing or physically hurting isn't in my nature. It's something I simply would not do.
Or even think about? Asked Sandra.
Peter spread his arms. Well, we all think about things, but there's a world of difference between an idle fantasy and reality.
If there weren't, thought Peter, I'd have had you and my secretary and 100 other women right on this very desktop.
Sandra rearranged herself slightly in her chair.
I don't normally talk about my personal life while on the job, but I went through something very similar to what you did, Peter. My husband, my ex-husband, as of a few months ago, cheated as well. I'm not a violent person either. I know some would consider that an unlikely thing for a police officer to say, but it's true. But when I found out what Walter had done, well, I wanted him dead, and I wanted her dead. I'm not given to throwing things, but when I found out, I threw the remote control for our TV across the room. It smashed into the wall, and the case broke open. You can still see the spot on the wall where it hit. So I know, Peter, I know that people have violent reactions when this sort of thing happens.
Peter nodded slowly.
But I did not kill Hans Larson.
We believe it was a professional murder. I didn't arrange for his killing either.
Let me tell you exactly what my problem is here, said Sandra. As I said, we're looking at a professional hit. Frankly, that sort of thing costs a lot of money, especially with the extra work this one involved. You and Kathy are better off than most of her co-workers. If anyone could have afforded this sort of thing, it would have been you or her.
But we didn't do it, said Peter. Look, I'd be glad to take a lie detector test.
Sandra smiled sweetly.
How thoughtful of you to volunteer. I have portable equipment with me.
Peter felt his stomach muscles tighten.
Really?
Oh, yes, in fact, it's a Veriscan Plus. That's made by your company, isn't it?
His eyes narrowed.
Yes.
So I'm sure you have a lot of faith in its abilities. Would you really be willing to take such a test?
He hesitated.
With my legal counsel present, of course.
Legal counsel? Sandra smiled again.
You haven't been charged with anything.
Peter considered.
All right, he said, if it'll put an end to all this, yes, I'll agree to a test, here and now, but in the absence of counsel, you may ask 3 questions only. Did I kill Hans Larson? Did I kill Rod Churchill? Did I arrange their deaths?
I have to ask more than 3 questions. Calibrating the machine requires it, you know that.
All right, said Peter. Presumably you have a script of calibration questions. I'll agree to the test so long as you don't deviate from that script.
Very well.
Sandra opened her attaché case, revealing the polygraph equipment within. Peter peered at the device.
Don't you have to be a specialist to operate those machines?
You should read your own product brochures, Peter. There's an expert system AI chip inside. Anyone can operate one these days.
Peter grunted.
Sandra affixed small sensors to Peter's forearm and wrist. A flat panel screen popped up from the attaché case, and Sandra angled it so that only she could see it. She touched a few controls, then began to ask questions.
What's your name?
Peter Hobson.
How old are you?
42.
Where were you born?
North Battleford, Saskatchewan.
Now lie to me. Tell me again where you were born.
Scotland.
Tell the truth. What is your wife's first name?
Catherine.
Now lie. What is your wife's middle name?
Tipring.
Did you kill Hans Larsen?
Peter watched Sandra carefully.
No.
Did you kill Rod Churchill?
No.
Did you arrange the killing of either of them?
No.
Do you have any idea who killed them?
Peter held up a hand.
We agreed only three questions, Inspector.
I'm sorry.
Surely you don't mind answering one more, though.
She smiled.
I no more like having to be suspicious of you than you like being a suspect. It would be nice to be able to scratch you off my list.
Peter thought. Damn it.
All right, he said slowly. I don't know any person who might have killed them.
Sandra looked up.
I'm sorry, I guess I upset you when I went beyond what we'd agreed. There was some very strange activity when you said person. Would you please bear with me for just one moment more and repeat your last answer?
Peter yanked the sensor from his arm and threw it on the desktop.
I've already put up with more than we agreed, he said, an edge in his voice. He knew he was making matters worse, and he fought to keep panic from overwhelming him. He pulled a second sensor off his wrist. I'm through answering questions.
I'm sorry, said Sandra. Forgive me.
Peter made an effort to calm himself.
That's all right, he said. I hope you got what you were looking for.
Oh, yes, said Sandra, closing her case.
Yes, indeed.
It didn't take long for Spirit's artificial life forms to develop multicellularism, chains of distinct units attached together into simple rows. Eventually, the life form stumbled onto the trick of doubling up into two rows, twice as many cells, but each one still exposed on at least one side to the nutrient soup of spirit-simulated sea. And then the long rows of cells began to double back on themselves, forming U-shapes, and eventually the U-shapes closed over on the bottom, forming bags. Then at last, the great breakthrough. The bottom and top of the bag opened up, resulting in a cylinder made of a double layer of cells open at both ends, the basic body plan of all animal life on Earth, with an eating orifice at the front and an excretory one at the rear. Generations were born, generations died, and spirit kept selecting.
Chapter 40. It had taken some work, but on December the 4th, Sandra Philo had gotten the monitoring warrant she requested, allowing her to place a transponder inside the rear bumper of Peter Hobson's car. She'd been given a 10-day permit by the judge. The transponder had a timing chip in it. It had operated for precisely the period authorized and not a second longer. The 10 days were now up, and Sandra was analyzing the collected data. Peter drove to his office a lot, and also went frequently to several restaurants, including Sonny Gottlieb's, a place Sandra quite liked herself, to North York General Hospital, he was on their board of directors, and elsewhere. But there was one address that kept appearing over and over in the logs, 88 Connie Crescent in Concord. That was an industrial unit that housed four different businesses. She cross-referenced the address with Peter's telephone records, obtained under the same warrant. He'd repeatedly called a number registered to Mirror Image, 88 Connie Crescent. Sandra called up InfoGlobe and got screens full of data about that company. Mirror Image Limited, founded in 2001 by Wunderkind Sarkar Muhammad,
a firm specializing in expert systems and artificial intelligence applications. Big contracts with the Ontario government and several financial Post-100 corporations. Sandra thought back to the lie detector test Peter Hobson had taken. "I don't know any person who might have killed them," he'd said, and his vital signs had been agitated when he said the word person. And now he was spending time at an artificial intelligence lab. It was almost too wild, too crazy. And yet Hobson himself hadn't committed the murders. The lie detector had shown that. It was the kind of thing the law enforcement journals had been warning was coming down the pike. Perhaps now at last it was here. Here. Sandra leaned back in her chair, trying to absorb it all. It certainly wasn't enough to get an arrest warrant. Not an arrest warrant, no. But maybe a search warrant. She saved her research files, logged off, and headed out the door. It took 5 vehicles to get them all there, 2 patrol cars with a pair of uniformed officers apiece, a York Region squad car with a liaison officer from that police force. The raid would be conducted on York's turf. Sandra Filo's unmarked car, carrying her and Jorgensen, head of the Computer Crimes Division, and the blue CCD van, carrying 5 analysts and their equipment. The convoy pulled up outside 88 Connie Crescent at 10:17 a.m. Sandra and the 4 uniformed officers went directly inside. Jorgensen went over to the CCD van to confer with his team. The receptionist at Mirror Image, an elderly Asian man, looked up in shock as Sandra and the uniforms entered.
"Can I help you?" he said.
"Please move away from your computer terminal," said Sandra. "We have a warrant to search these premises." She held up the document.
"I think I'd better call Dr. Muhammad," said the man.
"You do that," said Sandra. She snapped her fingers, indicating that one of the uniforms should stay here, preventing the receptionist from using his terminal. Sandra and the other 3 headed inside. A thin, dark-skinned man appeared at the far end of the corridor.
"May I help you?" he said, his voice full of concern.
"Are you Sarkar Muhammad?" asked Sandra, closing the distance between them.
"Yes."
"I'm Detective Inspector Filo, Metropolitan Toronto Police." She handed him the warrant. "We have reason to believe that computer-related crimes have been committed from this establishment. This warrant gives us authority to search, not just your offices, but your computer systems as well." At that moment, the door to the reception area burst open, and Jorgensen and the 5 analysts came in.
"Make sure none of the employees touch any computer equipment," Jorgensen said to the senior uniformed officer. The cops started fanning out into the building. One of the corridor walls was largely glass, overlooking a big data processing facility. Jorgensen pointed to 2 of the analysts. "Davis, Cato, you're in there." The 2 analysts went to the door, but it had a separate file lock.
"Dr. Muhammad," said Sandra, "our warrant gives us the right to break any locks we deem necessary. If you prefer we not do that, please unlock that door."
"Look," said Sarkar, "we've done nothing wrong here."
"Open the door, please," Sandra said firmly.
"I want to review this warrant with my attorney."
"Fine," said Sandra. "Jones, kick it."
"No," said Sarkar. "All right, all right."
He moved to the side of the door and pressed his thumb against the blue scanner. The deadbolt popped aside and the door slid open. Davis and Cato went in, the former going straight for the master console, the latter starting an inventory of the DASD tape and optical drive units. Jorgensen turned to Sarkar.
"You have an AI lab here? Where is it?"
"We've done nothing wrong," said Sarkar again.
One of the uniforms reappeared at the far end of the corridor.
"It's down here, Carl."
Jorgensen jogged down the hall, the 3 remaining members of his team following. Sandra walked in that direction, too, checking the signs on each door as she went. The Asian receptionist had appeared at the other end of the corridor looking worried. Sarkar shouted,
"Call Kajavi, my attorney. Tell him what's happening."
He then hurried off to follow Jorgensen. Sarkar had been working in the AI lab when the receptionist had called him. He'd left the door open. By the time he got back there, Jorgensen was looming over the main console, unplugging the keyboard. He motioned to one of his associates, who handed him another keyboard with a glossy black housing and silver keys. A diagnostic unit. Every keystroke, typed every response from the computer, every disk access delay would be recorded.
"Hey!" shouted Sarker. "These are delicate systems. Be careful!"
Jorgensen ignored him. He sat on the barstool and pulled a vinyl folder out of his briefcase. It contained an assortment of diskettes, CDs, and PCM CIA cards. He selected a card that would fit the drive on the console, inserted it, then hit some keys on his keyboard. The computer's monitor cleared, then filled with diagnostic information about the system.
"Top of the line," said Jorgensen, impressed. "Fully populated with 512 gigabytes of RAM, 5 parallel math coprocessors, self-referential bus architecture."
He tapped the spacebar. Another screen came up.
"Latest firmware revision, too. Nice."
He exited his program and began listing directories at the system prompt.
"What are you looking for?" asked Sarker.
"Anything," said Sandra, entering the room.
"Everything."
Then to Jorgensen. "Any problems?"
"Not so far. He was already logged in, so we didn't need to crack the password file."
Sarker was edging away from the group toward a console on the other side of the room. A console with a microphone stalk sticking up from it.
"Log in," said Sarker in a low voice. Then, without waiting for the prompt, "Log in named Sarker."
"Hello, Sarker," said the computer. "Shall I terminate your other session?" Sandra Philo had come up behind him, the rounded front of her stunner pressing into the small of his back.
"Don't do that," she said simply. She reached over to the console and flicked off the switch marked voice input.
At that point, Kowalski, the liaison officer from York, appeared at the entrance to the room.
"They've got a barber's chair upstairs," he said generally to the group, then looking at Sarker. "You give haircuts here?"
Sarker shook his head. "It's actually a dentist's chair." Jorgensen spoke without looking up.
"Scanning room, no doubt," he said. Then to Sarker, "I enjoyed your paper in last month's Journal of AI Studies. I'll want to search that room next."
He went back to typing commands on his black and silver keyboard. Sarker sounded exasperated.
"If you would just tell me what you're looking for—"
"Damn," said Jorgensen. "There are several encrypted banks here." Sandra looked at Sarker.
"What's the decryption key?"
Sarker, feeling perhaps that he had some measure of control at last, said,
"I do not believe I'm obligated to tell you."
Jorgensen got up from the stool. Without a word, a second analyst sat down on it and began typing commands.
"Doesn't matter," said Jorgensen with a shrug. "Valentina was with the KGB back when there was such a thing. There's not much she can't crack."
Valentina popped a new data card into the card slot and typed furiously with two fingers. After several minutes, she looked at Sarker, her face full of disappointment. Sarker brightened visibly. Perhaps she wasn't as good as Jorgensen had said. But then Sarker's heart fell. The disappointment on her face was simply that of someone who'd been hoping for a good challenge and had failed to find it.
"The Hansacker algorithm," she said in a heavily accented voice, shaking her head. "You could have done better than that."
Valentina pressed a few more keys, and the screen, which to this point had been filled with gibberish, was replaced with English source code listings. She got up, and Jorgensen went back to work. He cleared the screen, then replaced Valentina's data card with another of his own. "Initiating search," he said. The screen filled with a multi-column list of 200 or so terms in alphabetical order.
"There's massive storage online here," said Jorgensen, "under a variety of compression schemes. It'll take a while to hunt through it all."
He got up.
"I'm going up to look at that scanning room."
Peter had an evening board meeting at North York General today, and rather than waste the morning fighting the telephones at the office, he decided to do some work from home. But he was having trouble concentrating. Sarker had said he'd have the virus finished today, but Peter still felt he should be doing something himself. Around 10:30 he logged into Mirror Image, hoping to see if he could fathom how the Sims had gotten outside. After dialing in, he issued the Who command to see whether Sarker was also online. Peter wanted to send him an email hello. He was indeed. Peter then issued What to see what sort of activity Sarker was doing. If it was a background task, he probably wasn't actually sitting at the terminal, and so the email would be a waste of time. What reported the following. Node 002. User Sarker. Logged in at 8:14 and 22 seconds. Task text search. Well, a text search could be either background or foreground. Peter had high-level supervisory privileges on Sarker's systems. He called for an echoing of the task at node 002 on his own monitor. The screen filled with a list of search terms and a constantly updated tally of hits. Some, such as Toronto, had hundreds of hits so far, but others... Christ, thought Peter. Look at that. Sarker was searching for Hobson, and Pete asterisk, and Kath asterisk, and... Peter tapped out an email message. Nosy, aren't we? He was about to send it when he noticed the full search parameters in the status line. Search all systems. Within each system, search all online and offline storage, and all working memory. A search like that could take hours. Sarker would never order something like that. He was too well organized not to have at least some idea how to narrow the search. Peter glanced at the other search terms. Oh, shit. Larson, Hans, adultery, affair. Shit, shit, shit. No way Sarker would be doing a search like that. Someone else was inside the system. Node 002 was the AI lab at Mirror Image. Peter swung his chair to face his phone and hit the speed dialer key for there. The phone rang in the AI lab. "May I get that?" asked Sarker. Sandra nodded. She was watching the screen intently. Lots of hits on the common words affair had over 400 so far, but none on Hobson or Larson. Sarker moved across the room to the video phone and hit the answer key. The Bell Canada logo backflipped away. Peter saw Sarker's face looking worried. "What's..." said Peter, but that's all he said. In the background, over Sarker's shoulder, he saw a profile of Sandra Philo. Peter broke the connection at once. Philo, there, at Mirror Image. A raid. A goddamn raid. Peter looked at his screen, slave to node 002. Still no hits on Hobson. He thought for a second, then began tapping keys. Peter spun off a second session under Sarker's login name, using the password he'd heard Sarker use before. He then accessed the diagnostic tool's subdirectory and called up a file listing. There were hundreds of programs, including one called TextRep. That sounded promising. He called up help on it. Good. Exactly what he needed. Syntax, search term, replacement term, search parameters. Peter typed textrep/Hobson/Roddenberry/AI7-AI10, meaning change all occurrences of Hobson to Roddenberry on Artificial Intelligence System 7 through 10. The program set to work. It was a much smaller search, only one term, and a much narrower area to search, only four computers instead of the 100 or more that Philo was currently examining. With luck, it would make all the substitutions before it was too late. The console beeped, signaling its task was complete. Jorgensen was back, having found nothing of interest in the scanning room. He looked at the screen, then at Sandra. 13 hits for Hobson. Sandra pointed at the tally. "Display them in context," she said. 2 appearances of the word in an online dictionary entry for Hobson's choice. A user ID file equating Fobson with Peter G. Hobson. A computerized Rolodex with home and business addresses for Peter Hobson. and 9 more references, mostly within copyright notices, to Hobson Monitoring Limited as parts of various pieces of scanning software.
Nada, said Jorgensen.
He's got an account here, said Sandra, turning to Sarker.
Who does? He said.
Peter Hobson.
Oh, yes, we use some programs made by his company.
Nothing more?
Well, he's a friend of mine, too. That's why I have his home address in my Rolodex. Sarker looked innocent.
What were you expecting to find?
Chapter 41 Kathy Hobson was exhausted. It had been a long day at the office, slogging away at the Tourism Ontario account. She'd stopped at Miracle Food Mart on the way home, but the idiot in front of her had decided to unload all his change on the cashier. Some people, Kathy thought, should be forced to use debit cards. When she finally arrived home, she pressed her thumb against the file scanner, leaning on it as if it were the only thing keeping her from collapsing to the ground. The green LED atop the scanner winked at her, the deadbolt sprang back, and the heavy door slid aside. She entered her house, the door closed behind her, and the lock snicked back into place.
"Lights," she said.
Nothing happened. She cleared her throat and tried again.
"Lights."
Still nothing. She sighed, set down her shopping bags, and groped for the manual switch. She found it, but still the lights did not go on. Kathy made her way up into the living room. She could see the glowing LEDs on the VCR, so it wasn't a power failure. The entryway bulb was probably just burned out. She said lights once more, but the 3 ceramic table lamps, lamps that Kathy herself had made, remained dark. Kathy shook her head. Peter was constantly fiddling with the house controls, and it always took a while to get things working properly again. She lowered herself to the couch, spreading her aching feet out in front of her. Such a long day. She closed her eyes, enjoying the darkness. After a moment, remembering her groceries, she hauled herself up and headed down to the entryway. She tried both the light switch and saying the word lights again. Still nothing. She was about to bend over and pick up the bags when she noticed the phone sitting on the little table in the hall. The large red light adjacent to its keypad was on. She moved closer. The visual display said line in use. The phone hadn't rung. And Peter wouldn't be home for hours yet. He had a board meeting tonight at North York General. Unless...
"Peter?"
Her shout echoed slightly in the corridor. "Peter, are you home?" No reply. She picked up the handset and heard a high-pitched whine. A modem. She looked at the visual display again. Private caller. An incoming call. But whoever was using the modem had requested suppression of call display. Jesus Christ, she thought. A sim. She slammed the handset down, then picked it up again, jiggling the hook switch rapidly, trying to make enough line noise to sever the connection. It didn't do any good. Peter, of course, had the finest in error-correcting modems, and the sim apparently had equally good hardware. She moved quickly to the front door and pressed the unlock button next to it. Nothing happened. She grabbed the manual handle. The door refused to budge. She hit the in-case-of-fire override. The door was still jammed. She slid open the hall closet. It, at least, had no locking mechanism, and looked at the door control panel. An LED was glowing like a drop of blood next to the phrase, "Thwarting break-in." Normally, the doors would instantly unlock in case of a fire, but the smoke detectors denied that there was a fire, and some other detector said someone was trying to break in from outside. Kathy left the closet and looked through the peephole in the front door. No one was there. Of course. She was trying to remain calm. There were other doors, but the master panel showed them all to be in anti-break-in mode as well. She could try going through a window, but they were all locked too, and the glass was, of course, the best modern safety glass money could buy. The word she'd been fighting not to think finally pushed to the surface of her consciousness. Trapped. Trapped in her own home.
She thought about trying to trigger the smoke detectors, but of course neither she nor Peter smoked, so there were no lighters anywhere in the house, and Peter didn't like the smell of matches or candles, so there were none of those either. Still, she could set fire to some paper on the stove. That might set off the alarms, unlocking the doors. She hurried to the kitchen, taking care not to trip the darkness. The moment she entered, though, she knew she was in trouble. The digital clocks on both the microwave and the regular oven were off. The kitchen power had been cut. There was a rechargeable flashlight plugged into a wall outlet. She pulled it out of the socket. It was supposed to come on automatically when the power went off, but it was dead. Kathy realized that the power must have been off in the kitchen for many hours, and so the flashlight had depleted its charge, but that whine. The refrigerator was still on. She opened its door and a light went on inside. She felt the rush of cold air on her face. The sim knew exactly what it was doing. The VCR and the fridge were still on, but the stove and the outlet that recharged the flashlight were off. As was typical in a smart house, every outlet was on its own circuit and fuse. She made her way into the dining room and held onto the back of a chair for support. She tried to remain calm. Calm, damn it. She thought about getting a kitchen knife, but that was pointless. There was no physical intruder. The control box for the house systems was in the basement, and that's where the phone cables entered, too. Power and telecommunications lines were being systematically buried in response to fears that unshielded overhead lines caused cancer. Kathy inched toward the top of the stairs that led to the basement. She opened the door. It was pitch black down there. For their fifth anniversary, Peter and Kathy had treated themselves to a home theater system, so the blinds on the basement windows had been replaced with mylar-lined curtains on electric rails, and the curtains had been drawn. Kathy thought she knew the layout well enough to find the incoming phone line even in the dark. She stepped onto the top stair. The overhead sprinklers came on. No alarm, nothing to summon neighbors or the fire department, but cold water started showering down from the ceiling. Kathy gasped and ran back up into the living room. The sprinklers shut off behind her and came on in there. She moved onto the stairs leading up to the bedrooms. The sprinklers cut off in the living room and went on in the stairwell. Kathy realized that they were following her. The sim had presumably keyed into the motion sensors that were part of the burglar alarm system. Through the mist, she could see that the LEDs on the VCR were now off, presumably to avoid starting a fire by electrical shorting. Exhausted and wet, with no way to escape, Kathy decided to head for the bathroom. If the sprinklers were destined to follow her, she might as well be in the room in which they could do the least damage. She got into the bathtub and unhooked the shower curtain, using it as a tent to shield herself from the cold water. 3 hours later, Peter came home. The front door unlocked normally for him. He found the living room carpet soaked and could hear the sprinklers running upstairs. He hurried up to the bathroom and opened the door. The moment he did so, the sprinklers stopped. Kathy pushed off the shower curtain. Water streamed from it as she rose to stand up in the tub. Her voice was full of tightly controlled fury. "Neither I nor any version of me would ever have done anything like this to you." She glared at him. "We're even." Kathy quite sensibly refused to stay in the house. Peter drove her to her sister's apartment. She was still angry but was slowly calming down, and she accepted his embrace as they parted. Peter then went directly to his own office and logged onto the net. He sent an email message out into the world. Date, 15th of December 2011, 23:11 Eastern Standard Time, from Peter G. Hobson to my brothers, subject RTC request. I need to talk to you all in real-time conference immediately. Please respond. It didn't take long for them to reply. "I'm here," said one of his ghosts. "Evening, Pete," said another. "What is it?" asked a third. They all spoke through the same voice chip. Unless they identified themselves, there was no easy way to tell which sim was speaking. And even knowing the nodes they were using wouldn't tell him which sim was which. It didn't matter. "I know what's going on," said Peter. "I know one of you is killing people on my behalf. But tonight Kathy was threatened. I will not tolerate that. Kathy is not to be harmed, not now, not ever. Understand? Silence. Understand? Still no reply. Peter sighed, exasperated. Look, I know that Sarker and I can't remove you from the net, but if there's any repetition, we will go public with your existence. The press would go apeshit over a story of a murdering AI having taken up residence inside the net. Don't think they wouldn't do a cold restart to get rid of you. A voice from the speaker. I'm sure you're mistaken, Peter. None of us would have committed murders. But if you go public, people will believe your claim. You are, after all, the famous Peter Hobson now, and that means you will be blamed for the deaths. I don't care at this point, said Peter. I'll do whatever it takes to protect Kathy, even if it means going to jail myself. But Kathy has hurt you, said the synthesized voice. More than anyone in the entire world, Kathy has hurt you. Hurting me, said Peter, is not a capital crime. I'm not kidding. Threaten her again, harm her in any way, and I will see to it that you are all destroyed. I'll find a way to do that somehow. We could, said the electronic voice very slowly, get rid of you to prevent that from happening. That would be suicide, in a sense, said Peter, or fratricide. In any event, I know that's something I wouldn't do, and that means it's also something that you wouldn't do. You would not have killed Kathy's co-worker, said the voice, and yet you believe one of us has done that. Peter leaned back in his chair. No, but I wanted to. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I wanted to see him dead. But I would not kill myself. I wouldn't even think about killing myself, and so I know you wouldn't seriously think about doing it either. But you're thinking about killing us, said the voice. That's different, said Peter. I'm the original, you know that. And I know in my heart of hearts that I don't believe that computer simulacra are as alive as a flesh-and-blood person is, and because I believe that, you believe that too. Perhaps, said the voice. And now you're trying to kill Kathy, Peter said. At least that must stop. Don't harm Kathy, don't threaten Kathy, don't do anything to Kathy. But she hurt you, said the synthesizer again. Yes, said Peter, exasperated, she hurt me. But it would hurt me more if she were not around. It would destroy me if she were dead. Why? Said the voice. Because I love her, damn it. I love her more than life itself. I love her with every fiber of my being. Really? Said the voice. Peter paused, catching his breath. He considered. Was it just his anger talking? Was he blurting out things he didn't mean? Or was it true, really true? Yes, he said softly, understanding at last. Yes, I really love her that much. I love her more than words can say. It's about time you admitted that, Petey boy, even if you had to be pushed into it. Go get Kathy. Doubtless you took her to her sister's house. That's what I would have done. Go get her and take her home. Nothing more will happen to her. Chapter 42. The next day, Peter made sure Kathy got safely on her way to work, but he stayed home. He disconnected the electronic door system and had called a locksmith to come and put in old-fashioned key-operated deadbolts. While the locksmith worked, Peter sat in his office and stared out into space, trying to make sense of it all. He thought about Rod Churchill, a cold fish, undemonstrative. But he had been taking phenelzine, an antidepressant, meaning, of course, that he had been diagnosed as having clinical depression. But in the 2 decades Peter had known Rod Churchill, he'd seen no change in his demeanor, so maybe he'd been depressed for all that time. Maybe he'd been depressed even longer than that, depressed during Kathy's childhood, leading him to be the lousy father he had been. Peter shook his head. Rod Churchill. Not a bastard, not an asshole, just sick. A chemical imbalance. Surely that mitigated what he'd done, made him less culpable for the way in which he treated his daughters. Hell, thought Peter, were all chemical machines. Peter couldn't function without his morning coffee. There was no doubt that Kathy became more irritable just before her period, and Hans Larsen had let his hormones guide him through his life. Which was the real Peter? The sluggish, irritable guy who pulled himself out of bed each morning, or the focused, driven person who arrived at the office, the drug caffeine working its magic? Which was the real Kathy? The cheerful, bright, sexy woman she was most of the time, or the cranky, quarrelsome person she became for a few days each month? And which the real Larsen? The drunken, sex-crazed lout Peter had known, or the fellow who apparently had done his job well and been liked by most of his co-workers? What, he wondered idly, would the guy have been like if someone were to cut off his dick? Probably a completely different person. What was left of a person if you removed stimulants and depressants, inhibitors and disinhibitors, testosterone and estrogen? And what about children who'd received too little oxygen during birth? What about Down syndrome, people altered completely by having an extra 21st chromosome? What about those with autism or dementia, manic depressives, schizophrenics, those who suffer from multiple personalities, those with brain damage, those with Alzheimer's? Surely the individuals affected aren't at fault. Surely none of those things reflect the actual people, the souls in question. And what about those twin studies the control sim had mentioned? Nature, not nurture, guided our behavior. When we weren't dancing to a chemical tune, we were marching to the genetic drummer. Yet Rod Churchill had been getting help. If he'd really been killed in the way Detective Philo suggested, the sim would have known that Rod was taking phenelzine, would have looked it up in a database of drugs, would have understood what Rod was being treated for. Could the sim have failed to realize that although the treatment might be new, the condition could have been long-standing? Surely that would have been enough evidence to commute any death sentence the sim had been contemplating. No. No version of him would have killed Rod Churchill, knowing of this chemical problem. Pity him, yes, but surely not kill him. In fact, this called into question all of Sandra Philo's case. The Sims, after all, had admitted to neither of the murders, and all Philo's evidence pointing to Peter and from there to the Sims was circumstantial. Peter breathed a sigh of relief. He would not have killed